Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Ari Shah. Today, I am really excited to have with me via Zoom, Mike Palank. Mike is general partner at Mac Venture Capital, an early stage venture firm focused on finding ideas, technology and products that can be infectious. Mike, it's great to have you here with me today.
All right, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me on. This will be a good conversation.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. So let's dive straight in. Can you give for our listeners a bit of a background about yourself and kind of your journey, which has been varied and multiple into venture?
Yeah, for sure. I think I have a fairly atypical background for a venture capitalist, as does, I think, most of the team at my firm, Mac Venture Capital. But I often say, of the many jobs I've had in my career, this is by far the best. It took a while, but I found the career that I believe I was meant to do. And I hope it's the career I have for the rest of my life. In VC, you sort of have to re-interview every few years and convince people to continue to give you money. But I do hope this is the career that I can sort of retire with, if I ever retire. But and I say that because I think, you know, being a seed stage VC, being a generalist VC that I am, you have to draw upon a lot of prior experiences. And I have those. I mean, I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, moved to Chicago, Illinois to study finance and accounting and psychology. Really wanted to be an investment banker. My school, as my counselor told me, did not graduate investment bankers. But I hustled and got a job even better at a hedge fund in Chicago as an equity analyst, and was meeting and investing in small cap publicly traded technology companies. And I did love it. It's I think I'm one of those insatiably curious people. And I always joked and said, if I could get paid to just be in school forever, I'd love to study, you know, every subject. And I think, you know, short of that, being at a hedge fund or now being a VC, basically I've found a job that pays me to be a student. I actually did it. But when I was young, living in Chicago, we were just talking about the weather in London. The weather in Chicago is not great for about 9 months of the year. It's very cold, very windy. I had friends that had moved to LA after graduation. I'd come to visit them in, like, you know, April, where it was like 8 below in Chicago and sunny and 80 in LA. And I'm like, I need to get out there. And I've had sort of two passions in my life. One was media entertainment, movies, music. The other was space. And my senior year of college, I was in an internship that kind of exposed me to the entertainment business. And I started reading all these books on the entertainment business and came across a book called The Mailroom, which was an oral history about these folks called talent agents that represented artists and helped build their careers. And when I read that book, it was like this epiphany moment for me. It was like, this is what I want to do. I had dabbled in acting and screenwriting in college, realized I was an absolutely terrible artist. I wasn't a creative person, but I liked the creative. And here were these people called talent agents that were the business and strategists, you know, business people and strategists in the lives of these artists. I'm like, this is me. And I applied to all the agencies over their websites, and not a single one even responded to acknowledge receipt of my resume. And I'm like, this is dumb. I'm not going to move to LA. I know no one in the movie business. Like, it was a pipe dream. And I was about to shelve it. And right before I did, I wrote a letter to a gentleman named Sam Haskell, who had a chapter in this book. And Sam ran the television department at the William Morris Agency, was one of the most powerful men in television. And I sent it off, just like a handwritten letter. And I mailed it to his office in Beverly Hills, graduated college, ended up getting a job at this hedge fund called Coghill Capital Management. And I'm loving it. And I'm, I don't know, in week two or three, I'm sitting at my desk having lunch and my cell phone rings. I pick up and the voice on the other line says, I have Sam Haskell for Mike Palank. And I'm like, what? I'm like, okay. And he gets on the phone, says, Michael, I got your letter. I just wanted to say thank you. And like, my jaw dropped. I just couldn't believe that this guy was calling me. One of the most powerful men in television was calling me, a nobody in Chicago. And he's like, you know, what do you want to do? I'm like, I want to be a talent agent. I want to go work for you. I applied. I never even heard back. He's like, yeah, you're in Chicago. Like, we get so many people applying every week that the easiest way to filter out applicants are those that aren't here in LA ready to start tomorrow. He's like, if you really want to be taken seriously, you got to move out here. I'm like, well, I got a job now. I'm making good money. He's like, I don't have to say, you got to take the leap of faith. And on top of that, you're going to make no money coming up in the entertainment business. It pays incredibly poorly. But that was it. That night, I went home, bought a desk calendar, circled a year from that day, and said, I'm quitting my job in a year. I'm moving to LA. And basically, that's what I did. Moved to LA with no job and landed in April 2004. Within 3 months, I was an agent trainee at the William Morris Agency and got to meet Sam Haskell and thanked him for changing the trajectory of my life. And long story short, ended up becoming a talent agent. Went through the training program, which I sort of compare to the Karate Kid movie where Mr. Miyagi is having Daniel-san, wash his car, sand his floor, paint his fence. And he's like, I thought I signed up to learn karate. And like, what are you doing here? I'm doing all your tasks. And then he comes out of him. He's like, wait, oh, I know karate. You taught me karate without teaching me karate. And that was the agency training program where you're binding scripts, you're sending out packages, you're taking out trash. Like, you're doing the most menial stuff. You're assisting agents. And, sometimes you wonder, what am I doing here? I'm making like $500 a week if that. And then, you become an agent, you become an assistant, like, oh, wait, I know how to do this stuff. And so my first boss was a guy named Charles King, who I believe was maybe the only Black agent or one of the very few Black agents in the agency. And he had just signed a playwright named Tyler Perry and was putting together, his career. And so I had a front row seat to the building of Tyler's career. He signed Prince when I worked for him. He just had some really amazing artists, and Charles became a very close friend and mentor. And, now he's my partner at Mac Venture Capital. But I, when I was coming up in the entertainment business, this was when Netflix was going from DVD by mail to streaming.
Yeah.
It's when YouTube launched. 2005 is when YouTube launched, Spotify launched. And so I was there in this business. Talent agencies weren't really tech forward when technology was really changing the nature of entertainment. And I wanted to be more in the forefront of that and just wasn't comfortable sort of doing business as usual as the talent agencies were doing back then. And so I moved over to run business development for Will Smith's company for a number of years. And my goal there was to move him more into venture in the ways that Ashton Kutcher, Jared Leto, Robert Downey Jr. had started doing venture investments. And at that point in time, this is 2011, it was more about their children, Willow and Jaden, and setting their careers up. And I looked around and said, man, the tech ecosystem in LA is really becoming something. And it's a very unique and amazing ecosystem. I want to jump in with both feet. And decided to do a career pivot. And I ended up at an accelerator called Amplify and then a tech studio called Science. And through Science, ended up joining and running an e-commerce startup called Top Floor. Venture back, we raised $8 million from Google Ventures and others. And that was my sort of trial by fire of running a company. And for 2 years, we did that. And then I advised probably a dozen startups over the course of 2 years. Early stage, my super skill was I could build you a really intense financial model, help you think through seed fundraising strategy, help with decks, help with pitching investors and follow up. Did that for a bunch of great companies in LA. And then in 2015, teamed up with Charles King and launched a company called Macro in the media space that's been very successful. They just raised $100 million Series C. A couple of weeks ago, it was announced. And 2 years into that, we launched our first venture fund called M Ventures with a friend of Charles's from Howard Law in the 90s named Adrian Fenty. I can get more into Adrian, but he was the former mayor of Washington, D.C. And then M Ventures became Mac Venture Capital when we partnered with Marlon Nichols, who had a firm called Cross Culture. That happened in 2019. So now we're in, I guess, coming up on, what is that, year five, I guess, at Mac. We're on fund two. And it's just been a ride of a lifetime. I forgot to mention sort of for 12 years inside this story, I was nights and weekends side hustle as a CFO to a record label. So did that, understand the music business pretty well. So, I bring all this to the table as a VC. I joke and say it's the only job I think in the world where I could actually take advantage of everything I've done in my career. I really do. And all the people I've met along the way, And again, it's why it's the perfect job for me. Hope it's the last job for me.
Yeah, I mean, that is an incredible story. And we're going to get into a lot of the detail around some of the things you talked about. But just for a second, let's talk about Mack Venture Capital. So how large is the fund? What sort of thesis do you have? You said you are a generalist VC, but does the fund have a specific thesis? What geographies do you invest in? What sort of check sizes? Just give us the rundown on the fund.
Yeah, for sure. And this is obvious, but you know, I think your strategy, your construction model at a VC firm should all stem from, you know, what your superpowers are, what your passions are, what you feel like you were put here to do. And because of the diversity of Mack, and we have diversity of all type, I joke and say I'm the token white guy on the team, but I'm the only white man on the Mack team right now. My three founding general partners our Black men, our other team, our other junior partners, our men and women of you know, Asian descent, Black descent, white descent. We're from different parts of the country, different socioeconomic backgrounds, different professional backgrounds. So, you know, diversity is the through line at Mack, and that's in part why we're, you know, very purposefully a generalist fund. I think if you look, another through line is that we all chose careers that were service careers. You know, as a talent agent, you know, the artists in Hollywood, the artists are the center of the universe. You know, they are the most important thing in that ecosystem. They everything sort of stems from the art that they create. And an agent certainly is in service of those artists. In the same way, I think we all believe that entrepreneurs are the center of the tech ecosystem. Their creations are what power everything. VCs are in service of them. And I think to be a good VC, you have to be comfortable not being the center of the universe. You have to be comfortable being in support of that. And I think some VCs, especially who were former founders, have a hard time stepping out of the limelight, being not the center of the universe anymore. But, you know, I chose a career as a talent agent, as did Charles. Adrian chose a career as a politician to serve his constituents in the city of DC. You know, Marlon was a consultant before he got into venture capital, serving his clients. So we all chose these careers of service, which is why I think we purposefully gravitated and chose early stage, you know, venture capital, as opposed to the later stage where, you know, value add services, I think, are less important at that stage. But when you're investing a pre-seed or seed, absolutely, how you help your companies is of paramount importance. So, you know, our diverse backgrounds led to generalist strategy. You know, our need to be in service of people, I think, led to us to choose pre-seed and seed. And, you know, we wanted to be, you know, one of the larger checks in the rounds at which we invested. We wanted to be in the driver's seat. We wanted to join boards. So we did target, you know, a larger fund size to be able to write the size checks that were lead size checks. So Mack Fund 1, which was a 2019 vintage, was $110 million fund. That was our inaugural fund. And then Fund 2 is a 2021 vintage. And that is a $204 million fund. Mm-hmm. That we're investing out of now. And our construction strategy, our strategy is to write an average check of $2.5 million, aiming to get 10 to 15%. And we, I'd say half of the company, we have 85 companies in the portfolio, Fund 1, Fund 2 portfolios now. Half of those companies are based in California. Mm-hmm. And those half are equally split between Northern and Southern. But the other half of the portfolio is spread out among the United States. We have, I think, about 8 or 9 companies in Africa and a few companies in Latin America, and looking to grow those portfolios. But the U.S. is our focus and our backyards, because the Mack team is split or mostly in L.A., but Adrian is based in Silicon Valley. So we're Northern and Southern California. And so we would expect a good percentage of our portfolio to be in California, Northern and Southern. L.A., as we'll talk about, is a very important ecosystem that we're very involved in. And, you know, I'd say we are generalists, and you'll talk about some of the companies I've invested in. But, you know, where I've focused over the last few years, I think where I'm, you know, very excited about is it started out with aerospace, and that sort of broadened out to manufacturing, to supply chain logistics, cybersecurity, and defense. You know, given this environment that we're in, the geopolitical environment, the war in Ukraine, you know, some important adversaries in China, Iran, Russia, North Korea, you know, it's an interesting time in the world, for better or for worse. And as a VC, I want to invest in companies that are going to keep the world safe, And I think investing in those sectors hopefully will achieve that outcome in part.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, we'll dig into that in a bit more detail in the main pod. But I remember you and I spoke about this as well. You know, the reality is that, you know, everyone thinks of LA as kind of Tinseltown, Hollywood, etc. But actually, you know, as you said, there are multiple kind of industries in those various sectors, defense, aerospace, etc., which, you know, which have been built in LA and therefore can benefit from, you know, from great VCs like yourselves coming in and seeding those businesses. So, you know, let's talk about a few of those businesses. If there were sort of three ventures within either inside or outside of the portfolio that you're really excited about, what would those ventures be?
Well, I want to give sort of, I want to show the breadth of our, I guess, investing aperture. So I'm not going to give all space companies, even though I easily could, but I'll start with one non-space company, and they're top of mind because I caught up with them today. They're based in Miami, actually. And it's a company called Zigazoo. And I guess the easy way to describe them is TikTok for kids. I have a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old. I met the founding teams, a husband and wife team, Zach and Leah Ringelstein, during the pandemic when my kids, or my 5-year-old, who I guess to them was probably 3, was watching an alarming amount of YouTube. And it just killed me. I'm like, I don't know what else to do. I wish there was something that was an equal blend of candy and medicine that we felt like entertaining and he'd want to do it, but just wasn't sort of the cesspool that YouTube can be sometimes. And I met this team, and they're former Teach for America educators and former ed tech founders with a successful exit. And consumer social is really hard, and your knee jerk would be like to pass, but I really liked them and their story. And I felt like this was a product that the world needed, my kids needed. And, you know, I backed them, and it's just an extraordinary team and what they've done over the last 2 years. They become, you know, I guess, you know, one of the most well-known and successful consumer social apps in the kids space. Now they're actually broadening out and aging up a little bit. Raised a very successful Series A, I don't know, 9-12 months ago. And just a really special company. It's one of those companies we need in the world, you know, not to get too grand about it. But I think, you know, our kids need some stuff that isn't TikTok. Not just because of, you know, the national security issues behind TikTok, but
just the content. You know,
just the content. I think it really dumbs us down, and we need stuff again that is more positive, more educational, but also fun, because kids aren't just going to do their homework all the time. So I think Zigazoo really threads the needle very well, and I'm very proud of that company, and I'm on the board. And you know, we got Serena Ventures to come in, and Jimmy Kimmel invested, and Wheelhouse Entertainment invested, and Liberty City Media came in and invested in their A round. Causeway, which is the owner of the Boston Celtics, are investors. Talus Capital in the UK are investors. They've been great partners. So it's just a really great group. They've built an incredible team and just really love that company. The other two I'll mention, I won't maybe go in as much detail just for time's sake, but you know, when you think of launch in the space sector, everyone obviously thinks of SpaceX, and SpaceX has changed the world, no doubt. And without SpaceX, we would not be where we are in the space economy. But to say that SpaceX is the end all be all with launch and they're going to control the market from here on out is kind of ridiculous. And the next unlock and launch, you know, what SpaceX, you know, pioneered was the reusability of the first stage rocket. Bring that back and it lands vertically and you can reuse it. But the second stage that takes the payloads into orbit is, for all launch companies, is expendable. It burns up on reentry, and that's an expensive piece of rocketry that, you know, contributes to still relatively high launch costs. What Stoke, our company, is doing is, they're certainly going to use the first stage reusability. It's already been sort of perfected, but they're working on second stage reusability to bring back that second stage that delivers payloads in orbit to really further reduce launch costs, to open up the space economy even more so we can do even more things up in space. And I'm a firm believer that, you know, humanity's future, both here on Earth and off of Earth, is heavily reliant upon investment in space and progress made in space. It's just absolutely essential. So I think Stoke, you know, 10 years from now, we'll look back and people will look on it like we look at SpaceX, and just an amazing company that allowed for you know, falling launch costs, as well as kind of turning launch into something as mundane as taking a Southwest 737, you know, from LA to Phoenix or something. That's what Stoke's going to do. And I'm just, it's a team that came out of Blue Origin, and their milestones they've hit are just ridiculous. They're the fastest company to get to where they are in the history of launch. So very proud investor in that company. And then, you know, if I got it, you know, it's hard picking.
Like your kids, right? That's why I asked the question.
But maybe, let's see, maybe a third, I guess it's a company that I'm very passionate about. You know, they say in VC, the biggest winners are the companies you invest in when they're very non-consensus that over time become consensus. Mm. And man, can it be lonely and concerning when you are the one of the very few non-consensus investors, when people are like, I don't get this company. What are you talking about? But I invested in a company called NewView about a year and a half ago. They're based in Orlando, Florida. They're in the Earth observation kind of subsector of the space sector. And they're doing something that no other company's ever done, which is interesting, which is building out a constellation of satellites to map the Earth using LIDAR. We have Planet Labs that has, you know, looked at the Earth with optical, and a lot of companies that are looking at the Earth with synthetic aperture radar, and companies doing multispectral, hyperspectral, thermal IR, which are all important, have incredible use cases. But no one except for governments and the U.S. government has ever sent up a satellite to look at the Earth with LIDAR. And LIDAR is, I won't get into detail, but is a foundational data set for Earth observation and allows us to do things that you can't do with any other remote sensing capability. And on top of that, only 5% of the planet's ever been mapped with LIDAR. So huge unlocks across commercial, civil, defense applications, you know, for what this company NewView is doing. And I liked the founder and chose to dug in for my diligence and talk to a couple potential customers, and thought, just found out, you know, firsthand that, oh my God, this is an enormous market.
Yeah.
And the defense applications are just ridiculous. Like, there is so much interest. And yes, there is a huge technological hurdle that has to be overcome to make this a possibility. And it is a hardware business. So, you know, there is money that needs to be raised to make this a possibility, but it's not in the billions of dollars. And I just got so excited and I invested, and to see the team progress over the last year and a half has been extraordinary. And now we're in this challenging fundraising environment, and this company is raising a Series A. And man, if I can't get a single, I shouldn't say single VC, because some people have engaged and dug in, but like some of the blue chips, especially those that say they want to invest in dynamism or hardware, and, you know, I just can't get them to spend 30 minutes doing some diligence here and talking to some of the customers that I talk to. It's just like, oh, Earth observation is crowded, or this is too hard, or, you know, it's going to be too expensive. I'm like, just dig in for 30 minutes and you'll see. And I see it so clearly. I think I have this enormous winner. And I believe in it so strongly, have such conviction, and just can't quite get most VCs to get there.
Well, this goes back to what you're saying about consensus versus non-consensus. It feels like in the VC industry for a few years now, maybe less so at the moment, there's been, you know, more consensus where there probably should have been less, right? So there's been a lot of kind of party rounds, a lot of FOMO investing, et cetera, hype rounds. And in fact, actually, a lot of those hype rounds seem to have, you know, those companies seem to have either died a death, or, you know, in the 10-minute grocery delivery kind of sector, they've all died, right? Or consolidated completely.
Yeah.
So it kind of feels like, you know, I guess what you would probably say to most founders is you just got to keep plugging away. It takes 100 calls to get that one check.
That's
right?
Exactly what I say. That's exactly what I say. And, you know, so I am excited that I have this company that's non-consensus, that I see it so clearly. But, you know, at some point you do need it to become consensus.
Yeah.
Because if it stays non-consensus forever, well, you're not going to be able to raise the money you need to raise. And so, you know, not that this is the round where we need to get to consensus, but I need to get a few believers in. And we're making progress there. But NewView is a company, I think, you know, again, we'll talk about, you know, years from now, and as like we talk about Planet or Maxar, some of these real leaders in the Earth observation space today.
Yeah, amazing. Mike, look, thank you so much for doing this primer with me. We're going to dig into a lot of this stuff in the main episode, but for now, thank you so much.
For sure. Thank you.